Welcome to Murder with the Misses. I'm Darren.
And I'm Amy. And today we're going to tell you about Kirsten Hatfield. Now, this is the story of an 8-year-old girl, so it's kind of hard to tell these kids' stories, but they are part of true crime. And unfortunately, it is a sad thing that we deal with every day. So now, Kirsten lived in Midwest City, Oklahoma, with a single mom, Shannon, and her 3-year-old sister, Faith. We're back in May 13th, 1997. The girls shared a bed, and Shannon put them to bed at around 11:30. Then went to bed herself sometime after. Probably going around the house doing things that we can't get done with two kids running around. Now at around 3 a.m., Shannon heard a whine coming from the girl's room. Faith was known to talk in her sleep, and Shannon figured that that's what was going on. She walked over, saw that the girl's door was closed, which she thought was odd because she always kept it cracked. She pushed the door open and went back to bed. At around 6 a.m., Shannon went in to the girl's room to check on them and saw that Kirsten was not there. She panicked, checking her house, then running from door to door in the neighborhood, checking their houses. She came back home and called 911. When police arrived and started looking at the scene, they noticed that the girl's window was not only unlocked, but was slightly ajar, almost like when you try to shut it from the outside and you can't close it all the way because your fingers can't get in there, or because your fingers are in there and you can't get it to shut all the way. There was also a couple of drops of blood on the windowsill. The bedroom window looked out into the backyard, so police went out there and checked. They found more blood on a 6-foot-high wooden privacy fence. And next to that fence, caught on a tall weed, was a pair of Kirsten's underwear that also had blood droplets on them, and they were partially ripped. It was looking like an abduction, and sounds like it had to be someone familiar with the house because, like I said, the window to the girl's room went out to the fenced backyard. A stranger would not know that, or that they wouldn't get into the backyard without alerting a dog or causing the dog to bark or bite them. At least that's what it seems like to me.
And all that Faith could tell them was that a bad man came in and took my sister.
Yeah, she was only 3.
Yeah, Faith was 3 years old.
Yeah, so she couldn't give too much information. This was back in the 90s, so there wasn't like Ring cameras on neighbors' doors, so police immediately went to local businesses to collect surveillance footage to see if they could get any information on any abductors. One convenience store had footage from when a man came in asking questions about Jet Drive, which is the street where Kirsten lived. He was said to have been around 6'2" tall and about 230 pounds. He was wearing a blue and white striped shirt and matching baseball hat.
The police and community were all searching and talking to neighbors. The Heidi Search Center from Texas even flew in to help.
Yeah, and the Heidi Search Center is what it sounds like. Their website is stating that it is a resource for families and communities, providing educational programs, referrals, advocacy, and assisting law enforcement in search efforts for missing children and adults in San Antonio, Texas, and beyond. And I would say so, because it's like a 7-hour drive from San Antonio to Midwest City by car. Luckily, they flew in, so they probably got here in a couple of hours. But they did go above and beyond to come into Oklahoma to check. Missing persons flyers went out to tell people about 4-foot-tall, 55-pound Kirsten with her brown eyes and long brown hair. She was last seen wearing a t-shirt with lettering on it. There were no leads. The following week, some clothes were found in northeast Oklahoma City, so they went into action. Unfortunately, Shannon confirmed that these were not Kirsten, so they were back to square one. The Heidi Search Center went back to Texas in early June, but Shannon and volunteers from the community set up a command center at the elementary school. They coordinated searches with the local police, and the searches would turn up no new evidence, unfortunately. The FBI and OSBI were also involved. They ran the DNA evidence through CODIS, which is the Combined DNA Index System, but got no hits. Back then, technology was not where it is today, which we say that a lot too, so they were basically only able to tell that it didn't match anyone who already had DNA on file, and Kirsten would not be in the CODIS system.
After a few months of searching, Shannon told the media, "I'm tired and I'm beat, but I'm not giving up."
No, she would not give up. I mean, most mothers will not. Most fathers will not.
No, it's just...
It's your kid.
No, that's got to... You know, that wears on a parent.
Oh, yeah.
Physically, mentally. I mean, everything.
And we've touched on it before that it's worse to have a missing child than it is to have a deceased child in our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They're both horrifying things, but... To not know where they are, what's going on, what's happening, what they've been through.
Exactly.
You will dwell on that and sit on that for years or however long it takes for you to get an answer.
Yep.
Oh, it's just the mental turmoil. Searches would go on to stop in July, though. And Shannon did admit to authorities that she used drugs and had connections that possibly made her a target. She said, I certainly wasn't a perfect mother. I socially did drugs. But never around the kids. If that's the reason why Kirsten is gone, then I'm guilty. Your kids are vulnerable to your friends. And Shannon later said that she thought Kirsten would come home alive for at least a good year after the abduction. They had a couple of rumors and tips that they looked into, but they never really had any real suspects. And of course, the case went cold. Now in June of 2015... Detective Daryl Miller, a new investigator at the Midwest City Police Department, looked at the case and realizes that they could test some of this DNA because some of it wasn't even tested back in 1997. And what was tested could be redone with all the new technology and advancements that they now had. There was no match in the system still, but they now knew that it was an unknown male. None of this was Kirsten's blood. So maybe the suspect hurt himself coming over the fence or through the gate in the backyard or opening the window. Or I hope it was from a bloody nose or something that Kirsten gave him fighting back. But they started going back and re-interviewing everyone again. They zeroed in on 10 males and started collecting DNA and asking more questions. They called 56-year-old Anthony Joseph Palma into the station for more questioning. He had given his DNA already. But the detectives had noticed some inconsistencies when they re-interviewed him and then went back and checked the case files to bump his two stories together. Anthony lived just 2 houses down from Kirsten, both in 1997 and still in 2015. In his 1997 interview, he told police that he was asleep that night and woke up at around 2 to 3 a.m. because his dog was barking in the backyard. He said he just hollered for the dog to come inside and went back to bed. He didn't look to see what the dog was barking at. He just figured it was a cat or some other animal in the backyard. He told them that he didn't know Shannon, and he had never done any work on the property or anything like that. When they went to his house to collect DNA in 2015, they also spoke to his wife. He had been married since the incident in 1997, and she said that he still gets upset about the case when it's mentioned or on the anniversary of the abduction when it pops up on the news.
When asked why, she said, it's because it happened so close to the house.
Right. So that's why he would get upset, is because it was so close to the house. It would upset him every year. Now, Anthony would deny having any involvement in the abduction and voluntarily, like I said, let them take the DNA sample. And this is another one that you can watch his interview at the police station from 2015. He says that Shannon was on meth and cocaine at the time, so it was probably drug related. He had heard that another neighbor and her husband had been at Shannon's house that night and they got lit up. He had only one real interaction with Shannon, and that was when they ran into each other while she was out searching. Anthony said that he gave her some money to help with gas or whatever she needed. He also said that Shannon's brother Aaron was in town helping with the search and was sleeping under a bridge, so Anthony let him sleep on his couch. That he would stay a couple of nights and then disappear for a few days because he was on meth too. So Anthony ended up having to kick him out. So he didn't stay there long. He had said that he let the cops search his house in 1997, but there was no record of a search in the case file. And he admitted that he had been in Shannon's house before when a friend of his lived there prior to Shannon and the girls moving in, and that he had helped build the fence in the backyard. But remember in 1997, he said he had never been to the house. He thought the interrogation was a setup by police eager to close the case but they told him about the DNA evidence and showed him that it was his DNA in the backyard, on her windowsill, and on her underwear. That it was a 1 in 293 sextillion match to him. So pretty much no other possibility. They said that they were going to have cadaver dogs, a backhoe, ground penetrating radar, and the whole nine yards out to search his place. Anthony said, "I was just laughing about that yesterday." And the cops asked, "Well, what's so funny about that?" And he said, "If y'all were ever to go in that backyard, I've got dogs and cats everywhere in that backyard, but you're not going to find Kirsten Hatfield in my backyard." Police did use sonar equipment to search Anthony's place for a body, but nothing was found. He was still charged with the murder, though, because of the DNA putting him at the scene of the abduction, which blows Con Nip's theory of nobody, no crime out the window. So if you haven't seen our episode on Molly Miller and Cold Haynes to hear about Con, go on back and check that out. Within a month of his arrest, he tried to slit his wrist in jail, but the injuries weren't even bad enough to go to the hospital. But it was enough to put him on a suicide watch.
Prosecutors came out in February of 2016 saying that he was linked to another sexual assault.
Several sexual assaults, actually. In 1979 and 1980, he had a girlfriend. In the middle of the night, he crawled through her 8-year-old sister's bedroom window and touched her. He was convicted in early 1980 for assault and or battery with a dangerous weapon and was released from prison in 1986. In 1998, which is the year after Kirsten's abduction, he drugged his 17-year-old roommate. She recalled being naked in a bathtub with Anthony pouring water over her, and then she can't remember anything else. She believes he drugged her and then raped her by instrumentation. During his trial in October of 2017, one of Kirsten's friends testified he used to stare at her and Kirsten when they were outside playing. He gave them the creeps. She said he would always look at them in a way that adults should not. In fact, several witnesses testified about how Anthony sexually assaulted them. The jury deliberated for about an hour before finding him guilty. He got sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Police believe that Kirsten was killed shortly after her abduction, and that Anthony stayed in the house all those years to conceal evidence and maybe the location of her body, but they never found her. Other options are that he didn't want to leave too soon so that it wouldn't be suspicious, but then he got married and just stayed there. Or, as we've seen in other cases, some sexual predators or murderers like to stay close for their own sick pleasure. And we've also talked about before how people will insert themselves into the investigation when they're guilty. And here he is, giving her money for gas, letting her brother sleep on his couch. So he was heavily involved, which is disgusting. During this ordeal, Shannon found her faith and forgave Anthony, saying that initially she wanted him dead. "I wanted him to go to hell. And that is completely opposite of what we're supposed to do as Christians." When asked how she could forgive him, she told a reporter, "Because I had been forgiven, and it's as simple as that. Because I had been forgiven by Jesus Christ, I had to forgive." And that's this case. It's a really short one this time. Just kidding. We're not quite done yet.
Old Anthony was sent to Oklahoma State Penitentiary, which is in McAlester, Oklahoma. We locals know it as Big Mac.
Yeah, Big Mac. It's the maximum security prison down in McAlester.
Yeah, it's really sucky prison.
It really is. You really don't want to go there. Now, his cellmate, Raymond, was in for charges from 2010 of shooting with intent to kill, 3 counts of first-degree murder, felony in possession of a firearm, and using a vehicle while discharging a weapon. He was serving several life sentences for 3 gang-related murders he committed throughout 2006, all at different times. On January 11th of 2019, guards came by to do a unit check and saw Anthony laying on the floor, face down, and covered with a blanket. They ordered Raymond to remove the blanket, and when he took it off, they said Anthony was laying in a pool of blood and was unresponsive. It seems that Raymond had beaten Anthony and strangled him to death with an extension cord. I will say that I looked Raymond up, and don't see any additional charges or pending cases posted on any of the state or DOC records. So unless it's been pulled over to tribal court because of McGirt, then I don't see any evidence that he was charged with Anthony's murder. And I'm not too sad about it. Police say they were giving Anthony some time, and then they were going to go and re-interview him to try to find out where the body was. But that was going to be later on in 2019. And now they don't get that chance. I know that people are upset because now they'll never know where Kirsten's remains are. But realistically, he was quiet the whole time about his involvement and screamed his innocence until the day he died. So there's no guarantee that he ever would have talked to begin with.
Well, you know, and I'm not too surprised about him coming up, you know, dead at, in Big Mac because they have kind of a thing about people who are sex predators.
All prisons do, yeah.
Yeah, most of them do, but that. Big Mac's like the worst.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't play that shit around there.
Yeah. He worked for the State Capitol Parks Department at the time, then Lake Thunderbird. So he had access to some places that were way out of the way.
Right. So just because they didn't find her body at his house doesn't mean he didn't do it, because he had so many places to dispose of her, and there's so much coverage, or it would take so much coverage. This is a lot of land we're talking about here. Oklahoma is, we're not densely populated like some of the bigger places. We have a lot of open land and a lot of wildlife land. And so he had plenty of opportunity to put her anywhere.
Yeah.
And I came across some reports saying that there are people who actually believe that he's innocent. I guess they think this was a setup. But a setup for all those years, drumming up all the other victims who testified against him. And he had a wife and daughter when he was arrested. So they'd come to the realization that this was the man that they trusted and loved while he was out doing all this other stuff. There's heartbreak all around. And I hope that his daughter and none of her friends were victims. It's disgusting. Now, Shannon went on to earn a degree in criminology and worked in the Sex Offender Management Unit at the Department of Corrections. She even has worked with sex offenders, partially because she was hoping to come across someone who would be connected to this case. She does want the lake that he was working at around the time that Kirsten went missing to search that. She wants it searched, but she doesn't think that's going to happen. She said, "I'm also concerned that Palma's death provides an opportunity to be complacent, and I cannot sense a responsibility to investigate Palma for other missing person crimes. I am wise enough to know that Kirsten's worth is being ignored, but I'm also out of ideas that can bring her case to a just conclusion."
You know, if he worked for the state's, you know, parks department or whatever,
right,
they would have record of like what
where
section, like what sections, because you're, you know, you're assigned areas.
True.
And everything. And I mean, even whenever at Thunderbird Lakes and stuff like that, you know, you're assigned certain areas that you're supposed to go to.
Right. But if you're smart about it, you wouldn't dump the body in the area you were assigned to.
But you would know that area best.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole thing is that they haven't searched him yet.
They won't, and she's worried they will never.
Yeah, but that's the whole thing. It's like, what would it hurt?
What? Well, I think it's a money thing, maybe.
Come on.
Like, it costs a lot of money to drag a lake.
They spend more money on bullshit than they can go search. You know, they can go search for a little while, see if this kid's there.
There's also a bunch of programs that help people like this in cases like this.
Yeah.
Like, we've talked about that. Like, we just did the Angie Dodge case where her mom has... You know, she accepts donations for Fight for Hope, which helps DNA processing. I mean, like, there's so many different things.
There's a lot of programs out there that, I mean, that will actually help out in this type of case. They'll reach out and they'll actually pay for DNA.
Pay for searching lakes.
There's another place there. They sell coffee, and then part of their proceeds go to DNA testing and stuff like that. And I mean, I think that's just a great cause.
Yeah.
You know,
one of these days we're going to get there too.
Yeah, actually, absolutely. I mean, I would love to get to that point.
Yes. Because there's so.
Just for reasons like this right here. I mean, you know, because, you know, stuff that says that they're not going to have the funds or whatever. Okay. I'd love to be at the point where I can be like,
Here's some funds.
Yeah, here's some funds. Let's do it.
Because there's so many missing persons cases in Oklahoma alone.
And it's ridiculous because they're like, oh, we're underfunded. Whatever. You just bought a bunch of police cars.
Drive around looking at Camaros and Harleys. And
like, oh, well, that's government money. Well, government money should help out the other people too.
Preach it. Yeah. And I can understand where all these people are coming from saying that there's no way. Because there were victims before Kirsten. There were victims after Kirsten. So if a sexual predator realizes that if they kill their victim and they get away with it for all the years, it's not too far-fetched to think that he's probably killed other people too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We got to stop.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us on this one. Catch us on the next one.
Bye.